So I'm going to talk now about language transmission and acquisition among indigenous Mexican immigrants in New York. Unlike the previous talk, I don't have really hard data about language acquisition. This is more about the factors behind transmission or non-transmission, as the case may be. At this point, although it's very worth studying, we have very little data about how children are acquiring English or Spanish in these indigenous Mexican communities in New York. So I want to give just a background, since I know here in France, people are probably much less familiar with Mexicans, indigenous Mexicans, and Mexican history than in New York. So I wanted to give a kind of overview about, a very quick overview about language policy in Mexico and the linguistic situation today and the diversity and all of that. So we can start with a quote from a photographer, Matt Black, who documented a lot of the Mixteco farmers in La Mixteca in Mexico. And he said, chances are high that the food you've eaten recently was picked by a Mixtec immigrant, Black points out. He's probably undocumented, and he probably earned far less than minimum wage for that work. His community back home is most likely in an advanced stage of depopulation. And if the current trajectory continues, his culture and language, among the oldest in all of the Americas, will likely disappear in the next generation or two. So all of this is correct. Well, linguists wouldn't say any language is older than another, but that's okay. It's certainly a language family that can be traced many thousands of years, but the rest is very clear, that there is a very large population of Mixteco immigrants, one of the indigenous groups of Mexico, living mostly in California and New York. And they're working in kind of slave-like conditions, actually both in California and in New York, except doing different lines of work. In California, mostly in agriculture, and in New York, mostly in restaurants and delis, different types of menial labor. So we could look first to just get a broad idea of linguistic diversity in Central America. Just to review some numbers from the different countries of Central America, according to the Ethnologue, which is one of the better sources for language statistics. So we could see in Panama, on the bottom there, you can get an idea of how many languages the country has, living languages, and in what states of vitality they're in. So you have around 14 languages. And one is supposed to be dying, one is in trouble, three are vigorous, one is institutional. Oh, it must have been cut off there. And five or so, I believe, are between institutional and vigorous. Okay. Nicaragua, on the whole, 11 living languages, similar range. Honduras, 10 living languages, also endangered, almost all of them. El Salvador, only four indigenous languages. Belize has eight languages, most of them Mayan and then Garifuna. And then we come to Mexico, and all of a sudden we have 282 living languages. So it's a completely different order of magnitude in terms of linguistic diversity, totally unlike any of the neighboring countries. Among these languages, 87 are what the Ethnologue calls in trouble, and 32 are in the most advanced stage of trouble, that is dying. 75 are considered to be vigorous, although I would say that the Ethnologue is a bit generous in how it ranks or how it assesses vitality. In many cases, I think what it calls languages that are vigorous, I think to me seem far more endangered. So what is the, what are the kind of languages? What are the families involved here? There's many, far more language families than you would expect for a single country. So all of these listed here, Udu Azteken, Yuman Cochimi, Totonacan, Odemangean, Mihesokean, these are all not languages but families completely unrelated to each other, right? To compare that to Western Europe, you have two families, basically, Basque and Indo-European. And, well, you have Finno-Ugric languages in other parts, but basically three language families in most of Western Eastern Europe. Here you have, I think, 11 language families completely unrelated to each other in a single country. It's an extremely unique situation for a country that size. Where are they? They're mostly in the south, mostly in the areas that were more difficult to reach for the various colonizers of Mexico. And so you see the colored dots on the bottom there. Those are mostly in the states of Oaxaca and Guerrero. And those are the most linguistically diverse areas in Mexico. Those also happen to be the areas where most Mexican immigrants are coming from to New York, right? And this is considered by some to be a linguistic hotspot, linguistic endangerment hotspot, meaning that there's a high level of endangerment and a very high level of diversity. So just a very brief overview of language policy in Mexico. From 1520 to 1810, you could consider this a period of outright suppression, of course, genocide, forced assimilation. In 1936, there was linguistic diversity was recognized in some kind of capacity. And in 1948, there was this thing called Instituto Nacional Indigenista, which was the first official institute that dealt with indigenous languages, although this was still a period where languages were regularly suppressed in the school system. 1982 was the beginning of bilingual education. And with very little resources, of course, until now, there are very little resources. And, you know, untrained teachers and all of that, but that was the beginning of a turn around and the beginning of policy change. In 2000, there was a more substantive change. There were constitutional reforms, which led to the Instituto Nacional de Lenguas Indígenas and the Comisión Nacional de Lenguas Indígenas, two of the larger institutions that promote and document endangered languages in Mexico. And it's some kind of rights have been enshrined in the more recent Mexican constitution, namely in Articulo 4 and the 4th and 9th articles, which says, well, you can read it, I guess, las lenguas indígenas que se reconozcan en los términos de la presente ley y el español son lenguas nacionales por su origen histórico y tienen la misma validez en su territorio, localización y contexto en que se hablan. So it's just basically recognizing them as national languages, but not giving them any special rights as such. In Article 9, there's the right for every Mexican to communicate in their language without restrictions. So simply allowing people to speak their language freely. It's not much. There's a renewed interest in maintaining linguistic diversity in the last several decades. So bilingual schools have increased and educational materials have been produced in far more languages. But then there's still this economic cloud that's hanging over the head of all of these efforts. There's not much money devoted to creating these materials. And there are so many languages. So literacy was reduced over the last 40 years. Through general literacy programs from something like 25% to 6.9%. Today there's maybe 8 million something illiterate Mexicans, and from that number 1.4 million are speakers of indigenous languages, so they're slightly overrepresented among the illiterate population. According to INEGI statistics, 6% of Mexicans speak an indigenous language. Right. Of course, it's much larger than a lot of other surrounding countries as well. In New York, interestingly, there's a much higher percentage. So it's 6% in Mexico, but something like 17% in New York, So indigenous Mexicans are coming to New York, in fact, more, at a much higher rate than others, right? So something like three times the rate. Indigenous languages are spoken in the Mexican community at three times the rate in Mexico than in New York than Mexico. So we're talking about roughly 86,000 people speaking in indigenous Mexican language in the New York area. It's a lot. There's also an increase in people who self-identify as indigenous, which is, it can be due to larger immigration of indigenous populations. It can also be due to changes in how people are identifying themselves, how people are self-identifying. So there's actually a massive increase, a 68% increase among those Latinos who self-identified as indigenous in the U.S. Census. So the attitudes towards indigenous languages in New York City has been rather, it's mostly marked by ignorance. Very few people know that these languages exist. When they have been acknowledged, they've been acknowledged in a negative way. One quote I always like to cite is that of Herman Badillo, who is actually a champion of Puerto Rican rights in New York. But as you can see from the quote, he was quite backwards in his thinking about indigenous people and colonial history more generally. Yeah, especially sad since it came from somebody who's considered a leader in civil rights, to some extent, in New York. So he said that the problem is that in Mexico and Central America, there's never been a tradition of education. They're pure Indians, Incas and Mayans, who are about, you know, 5 feet tall with straight hair. And when they speak about La Raza, they're not talking about the Spanish language, they're talking about the original Indian language. And therefore, it's far more complicated problem than the problem we're used to dealing with, but nobody wants to seem to face up to it. So this is not an official policy, but this is very representative of even officials in those that know about indigenous languages. So it's they see it as a problem. And that's actually a very close reflection of the attitude towards indigenous languages in Latin America as a whole until recently. So to take a random example, we have the Guatemalan president from, I believe it was the mid-80s, Mejia Victores, who said, we must do away with the word Indian or indigenous. Our mission requires the integration of all Guatemalans. And that was, you know, just a typical quote, and that's the kind of attitude that has been brought to New York and to other places in relation to indigenous languages. It's now a challenge for people to eradicate the indigenous, the marks of indigeneity that are seen to be holding people back from integration. And this, of course, is a much wider problem in the US. These are the same ideology was imposed on Native Americans. This was a Native American boarding school whose function was to erase the Indian culture and the Indian language. The saying of the school superintendent at that time was, kill the Indian, save the man. Meaning that if you destroy what is Indian in these people, you're somehow saving their humanity. And there were these before and after pictures that were quite popular during the same time period where you see like this was supposed to show the benefits of Western civilization. The before picture of a Navajo man is supposed to show him as a savage and you know, give him a shave and put him in a suit, and now the American government has civilized these tribes. So unfortunately, I think some of the same practices that are now, we look back on this in horror, but a lot of the same practices have actually been continued, but you know, non-explicitly. There's also a paradox in that we kind of look up to the great civilizations of Central America, the Aztecs and the Mayans and others, and there's enormous shows in all of the major museums in New York about the Mayans and the Aztecs. But we don't even know that the heirs to this civilization are washing dishes and cleaning cars and doing all kinds of menial labor all around the city. Those people are completely invisible and they're not at all connected to this these civilizations which all students read about and we go to the museum and see. So when they are recognized, they're viewed as ignorant, mute, provincial people. So I wanted to just review some of the kind of language ideologies of some of the people that we work with. I wanted to really focus on children, but unfortunately there's so little data on children's speech that we'll kind of get there by way of looking first at language ideologies in the speaker's own words. So let me see if I can pull this up. One of the things that we do at Ella is to try and document language attitudes as well. First, as a as a historical document, also to understand why languages are shifting and how they're shifting. Let's see. Whoops. So,
that's how we know about what's happening. Makapach al mas
si aves makasa niyo. Ahorita habla mixteco, hablan español, inglés, tres. No todos son así. A veces algunos le dan pena hablar, le dan pena hablar a frente de las personas. Pero como hace 3 o 4 días, estaba yo discutiendo con mi hermano porque llegó un maestro de Edwin en la casa. Yo empecé a hablar con él y él me gritó, ¿por qué me gritas? Dice, ¿no te da pena hablar dialecto en frente de ellos? Eso no tiene nada que ver, le digo. Uno se nota, uno se ve. Aunque mi hermano se molestó un poco conmigo. Aunque yo le digo, yo siempre le digo a mi hermano, aunque tú tratas de hablar en español, pero ¿qué pasa? Tu español no es correcto, le digo. Siempre falta un punto o un acento ahí, le digo. Y siempre le digo a él y se enoja más peor conmigo.
¿Edwin daba cuchillo? No te da pena, es que rehabla.
No sé. No sé.
Tú, ya, calma, mi. Calma, mi color. No quiere hablar.
No sé.
So, that was just one video, but you actually see there some things that are very representative of the larger community. First of all, this phenomenon of hiding the language in front of strangers. That's common, especially more among men than women, I think. I think it's not uncommon that women are more used to speaking the language and their husbands are the ones who are embarrassed. There's this idea that it's futile to hide your language also, that even if you try and hide your language, people will still know that you're not a native Spanish speaker. And the third element there was this disconnect, which we see over and over again, between what the parents think that they're doing with their kids and what's really happening. So the parents, most of them will always say that their children speak whatever language it is that they speak, Mixteco or some other language. They'll say, oh yeah, at least they can understand. In reality, when we try and verify it, children barely know anything in their parents' language in New York. And this is quite common, not just among the Mexican community. Don Kulik wrote about it in a very interesting essay, a book, 1992, his work on the Gapun, a group in Papua New Guinea, who blamed the children for language shift. But it was very clear when he actually observed what was going on that the parents were speaking a lot of Gapun around the children. But when they were addressing the children directly, they would avoid Gapun. But in their minds, they didn't see it that way because they're speaking Gapun most of the time, and so the children are somehow immersed. But as studies on acquisition show, it's not really enough to be immersed in a language. You have to be spoken to, right? So even if the kids are immersed in it, they're not going to learn it until they're spoken to in that language. And that's what's happening with this community, that they're hearing the language all the time, but they're not really understanding it. Another, we can just play this. This is another side of the issue, which is relevant to transmission. And this is from a recording we made with several Nahuatl speakers in New York.
Mexcotlali, que maná ni pilquense o ni pisilce, ni estudia uno mashle, ne pa ese lugar se tlaltipa. Toca chote, campana no mashle, ni huyaya pa ampa tlewanta mashleone, ni pano que se huye cualante, ken que ken se pampa no ni se coni testa tliaya no ama que postequiaya no la macuilo ya que pesque shiwit pesque peca pase cuale ni mati ama ni eco quense de ni tlacuilo o ni tlacuiloa. Texmacaya se textlacoculiaya con M, huaquino, texcuatlapanque, yeca asnequisquia mapanoca sequino con M, tena texpanoco, pampa se huey cuesole. Eso es todo.
Yeah, I could have explained that in a sentence or two, but I think it's more interesting to hear it in the first person. So this is other elements, again, which are very important for transmission. Physical abuse of indigenous Mexicans at the hands of their mestizo neighbors, you know, as children. And as a result of that, wanting to protect their own children from that kind of abuse. Now, for many of these languages, there's been something that's called language, there's something that's been described as language suicide. That is, there's an article about the decline of Totonaco in one area in Puebla. And it was claimed that this is a case of language suicide. But with this kind of background, you know, considering that there are these traumatic experiences in the backgrounds of so many of the speakers, it's a question, really, if the decline of these languages in their places of origin is ever really a language suicide, right? I mean, there are these undocumented events that really affect whether or not somebody is going to teach their kids their language, right? This is the idea behind language suicide. Just to give you an idea, by Denison, a speech community sometimes decides for reasons of functional economy to suppress a part of itself. There comes a point when multilingual parents no longer consider it necessary or worthwhile for the future of their children to communicate with them in a low-prestige language variety, and when children are no longer motivated to acquire active competence in a language which is lacking in positive connotations such as youth, modernity, technical skills, material success, education. The languages at the lower end of the prestige scale retreat from ever-increasing areas of their functional earlier domains, displaced by higher prestige languages until there's nothing left for them to be appropriately used about. In this sense, they may be said to commit suicide. Well, this is all accurate, except that for these cases of really what lies behind these decisions, right, to not pass the language on. It's more than just a matter of prestige, although that definitely plays a role. Okay. Just some other kind of ancillary issues in transmission that I wanted to also to introduce you to some of the people that we've worked with. So this is a little meeting that we held, what was it, maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago now, with speakers of different languages. So on the far left is a speaker of Amusco, Jesus, Otomangain language, and then Jose, Totonacan speaker, Irwin, Nahuatl speaker, and Margarito, a Mixteco speaker. And we asked them to reflect about their own language experiences, the value of their own languages, and issues in transmission. Note that all of these, well, these four people represent three completely distinct language families. So this is not, do you understand Spanish?
Okay.
Yeah, I'll have to summarize. I'll just summarize that. Basically, what he says is that you have this paradox back home, which is that now that bilingual education has been institutionalized, you do have a younger generation who can actually read and write in their language for the first time, well, in centuries. But they're not interested in reading or writing. They're interested in the other things that have come with that, the technology, internet, you know, things that will take them out of their village setting. So the older generation can speak the language but can't read and write it. The generation who can read and write it is not interested in speaking it. So you have this weird situation that he describes there. Another one of them talks about Mixteco being more difficult to speak in Acapulco than in New York, which is another interesting element, because in Acapulco, everybody knows that if you speak like that, it means you're this backwards person from the mountains, right? In New York, it's just another language, right? So there's another kind of interesting dynamic of cities that things that are stigmatized back home are kind of anonymous here. And there's the notion that indigenous languages are difficult, which he also mentions. And he goes over these kinds of tonal, minimal pairs in his language and says, like, look how hard this is. I don't know if he actually had that idea before we started working with him, or the more we worked with him, the more he started to feel that his language was difficult. But there is that notion that the languages are complicated, and that some people even think that their own languages have no rules, have no grammar, because they're taught that, I mean, traditionally there was a lenguaje and a dialecto, and the dialecto was kind of this, you know, it's a language without rules, a language that cannot be written. So I wanted to look more specifically at this one group, the Mixtecos. The groups that we've encountered so far are more or less the ones there: Mixteco, Triquis, Amusco, Tlapaneco, Mazatec, Zapotecos, Cuicatecos, Otomi, Chinantec, Nahuatl, Totonactepewa. Some of these, some speakers we've worked with, and others we've just encountered. You can see in the two pictures below, kind of a before and after picture of pre- and post-colonial Mixtecos. This is from a codex, historical codex. And the picture on the right is a kind of a typical scene from a Mixteco agricultural village. The area is very dry and poor, as we'll see. Again, we're talking now about this little area here in the green. The green dots represent the Mixtecan languages. So why have so many Mixtecos come across the border? Well, it's their area, La Mixteca, has been declared an ecological disaster zone by the World Bank. There's 1 million acres ruined by soil erosion, and that was largely the fault of the World Bank itself and other organizations that were pushing for a so-called Green Revolution, which involved a lot of fertilizer and a lot of inappropriate farming methods that ended up destroying the land after thousands of years of agriculture. It has a very low corn productivity rate. And NAFTA was the final blow. The North American Free Trade Agreement all of a sudden destroyed whatever they had left. The price of corn was cut in half. So there's absolutely no life in this place now, basically. It's now the poorest zone in all of Latin America, and there's rampant malnutrition there. As a result, 250,000 Mixtecos have immigrated. Some areas have lost more than 80% of their population, right? So this is, this in itself, these are causes of language endangerment. Yeah. So there's a background of extreme poverty. And how does that play out when groups from such desperate areas come to New York City? What are some of the consequences of their background? Well, one of the things is education. So Semple showed in a recent article in the Times that while no other immigrant group had a high school dropout rate of higher than 20%, and an overall dropout rate of and the overall dropout rate for New York City was 9%. Mexican and Mexican American students had a dropout rate of 41%. So you can see a comparison between Mexican, Dominican, Chinese, Jamaican, Guyanese, and Ecuadorian. These are all large immigrant groups in New York. This column shows 16 to 19 year olds who are in school, high school, or have graduated, and those are the numbers for college. In both cases, the numbers for Mexican students or Mexican American students is way below the others, right? So this was a kind of crisis, and this led to one of the interviewers that Semple spoke with led him to say the city may have a large Mexican underclass for generations because of this. So now there is a large multimillion dollar project funded by the Deutsche Bank to do something about these rates. Who knows if that's going to succeed or not. Another issue there is that children of Mexican, indigenous Mexicans especially, are being left back massively, right? They're being misidentified as Spanish speakers. So in high school, or below high school rather, in elementary school, and as soon as they enter the school system, they're not speaking as much as other children. Now they assume that because they have a Spanish name and they're from Mexico, they must be Spanish speakers. So they put them in the Spanish class. Then when they're not speaking Spanish, they're treated as having a learning disorder. And so then they're put in even another class, which is special for those with language disorders, learning disorders. Actually, it's quite complicated what's going on there. Nobody really understands exactly. On one hand, the school system says that all these children have learning disorders. On the other hand, the social workers and others in the community will say that this is just a mistake, that these children actually have an indigenous language as their first language and not Spanish. I don't know what to think yet. I've been working in some capacity for several years with the communities, but I have never seen a children of indigenous Mexican parents whose dominant language is that of their parents. It's usually English, actually, but it's a kind of different kind of English. Either, I don't know, maybe if there was enough decades, this would become a kind of Creole, but there's a kind of English, it seems, that's emerging from this young population, children of indigenous immigrants, mostly because the parents themselves will speak Spanish to the kids, but they don't speak Spanish fluently. So the children are acquiring a kind of Creolized Spanish, and then they're hearing English in school. It needs more study. So the phenomenon of late talkers in the population is quite real, but we need some comparison. So there's questions like, is this a case of a word gap? Like, are children just not hearing enough words? Are they spending too much time in front of the television? Is this a cultural thing? In other indigenous cultures from the area, you don't speak to children until they reach a certain age. They're not treated as human beings until they reach some age of 4 or something like that. So you speak, around them, but you don't really speak to them as much as you would in Western societies. Or, as I said, is it the case that parents are forcing themselves to speak a language that they don't speak well? I think that the last one is the case. And then you have these different models of assimilation on top of everything. So I talked about this a little bit, I think, in the last talk, that there's these subtractive and additive models of assimilation. So you have different, depending on the background of the immigrant group, you have different ideas about whether a language can hurt your chances of success or whether a language can help you. If you look at the economically successful immigrant groups in New York, subtractive assimilation is there, of course, but it's not a strong feature of New York's more, at least economically successful immigrant groups. So the Chinese, the Koreans, the Russian, French, Spanish, Yiddish, they all have resources for promoting their language. So there'll be Sunday school, there'll be after school programs. I went to school, to high school, in a school where almost, I don't remember, but more than half of the children were Korean and Chinese. And very few of them did not speak Korean or Chinese. They all of them spoke the language of their parents, almost all of them. That was the norm, even those that were born here. That's not at all the case for other communities. And as I said earlier, it's something, part of it is ideologies that come from post-colonial societies, that your culture will hold you back from assimilating. That is a very common idea in post-colonial societies. Abandon your language to get ahead. So what can we do? What are we trying to do, starting to do? We would like to start educating teachers and other relevant parties about indigenous language issues in New York, getting the larger languages like Mixteco and Nahuatl represented or somehow acknowledged in the school system, because we're talking about thousands of children now. Supporting after-school programs and pre-K programs in indigenous languages. Of course, this is like a far reach at this point, where even in New York, the budget is always haggled over and very thin. But the cost of not doing this kind of thing is much greater than the cost of doing it. That is very clear. When you create an entire underclass of Mexican immigrant children, you know, what could be worse than that? And supporting literacy programs for parents in indigenous languages. This is now it's too late to call it a pilot program. It's almost been going on for a year. It's a small program involving just four or five families, mothers, and in this group they actually speak different languages, Nahuatl, Mixteco, and MAM, a Mayan language from Guatemala. And the idea, which has evolved a bit over time, is to kind of do an exchange. We teach them English, and in turn, we try to learn something about their language. And I, myself, am actually very interested in Mixteco dialectology and language variation and the language family, so it's something of academic interest to me. So there is this space to kind of value the language, especially in regard to the children, because there's also children present there. To see them with outsiders who are interested in the language and not laughing at the language is, I think, a positive thing. And for the mothers also, because they're, you know, the whole idea of them teaching their language is totally new to them. It's, you know, not a language that you can learn in a classroom. It's, as I said, these are very undervalued languages. So this is still in its early stages, but I think it's very promising and something that's very necessary in New York. So that's all I have to say about that. Thank you.
Anyway, I mean, it's all very. It gives us a lot of things to think about, right? Because we have to. I think it's. We haven't thought. I mean, in the LGIDF project, we haven't thought about the endangered language angle, right? But it's here as well, right? Because the languages, some of the languages we are. You know, we are describing or we want to treat in our archive our endangered languages, but here we have different endangered languages, the languages, African languages, you know, Soninke or Bambara. I mean, they're big languages now, but not well, but some of those, some speakers must have other languages as well. So but we haven't given it any thoughts so far, right? So I don't know. We have to think about. We really have to think about it, and
just endangered language in general. I think that maybe some kind of language spoken here in France, in Ile-de-France, they share an important thing is that the minorization of the language. And for example, on Africa, most of the languages are considered like as dialect, and they have no value for the people because they are not language. They are considered in the bottom of the top of the language hierarchy. And I think that's a kind of minorization that we have also in Ile-de-France, and that it's the case also in New York City with Mexican language, Mexican indigenous language.
But there's the teacher's, well, I can speak with that microphone, but there's the teacher's viewpoint. I mean, for example, from the teacher's viewpoint, Soninke doesn't exist. They don't know, I mean, it has an name. But from the speaker's viewpoint, Soninke is a big language, and there are many speakers. So it's a very active, it's a very active language. So the speakers themselves don't devalue Soninke, right? But maybe they will do that for smaller languages from Cameroon, or I mean, there are smaller languages that are less represented. We started that with Soninke, which has a lot of speakers and many people, and they're conscious that their language is very active. But from the teacher's viewpoint, that we were talking about this morning, the Soninke is devalued, and from people's viewpoint, from l'homme de la rue's viewpoint, it doesn't exist. I mean, it's just it doesn't have a name.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a different angle, different viewpoints. I mean, when you think about devaluing languages, there are different viewpoints, right? So we should, because Daniel was talking about the speaker's viewpoint. Some speakers decide that it's not worth it. Speaking a certain language to their children because it has no value to their own eyes. It no longer does have value.
Mm-hmm.
The speakers themselves. So it's interesting to sort of have a list of the different viewpoints from which you consider a language to have no value. Right? There's the speaker's viewpoint, there's the teacher's viewpoint, there's the neighbor's viewpoint, there's the children's viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they don't necessarily correspond. They don't necessarily.
No, no. Usually they don't. Yeah, I should have made a better effort to relate it to the situation here in Paris. But I think that the parallel to the African languages spoken here is probably pretty good, because many of those languages are smaller, much smaller than Soninke. Most of those languages do not have any official existence, and they are undervalued and they're endangered. I mean, most of the languages of Gabon, for instance, are giving way to French. It's identical, I think. And so you could have similar programs here that have, you know, that are multifunctional. If there's an interest to experiment with literacy in those languages, I mean, just like in Mexico, there's no tradition of, in recent times, no tradition of literacy for many of those languages. So if there is an interest in trying to do something with the languages, creating literacy, creating even, you know, literature, I think that could be valued. And at the same time, in the same context, that's the way students who have linguistic interests can get involved and, you know, have this exchange where they're providing some service to the speakers or the community, and they're able to do their own linguistic research. So the people, you know, like the graduate students in this literacy group, all have linguistic interests in Mixteco and other, you know, indigenous languages. So these are kind of like multifunctional programs that could be experimented with here as well, and say with the African languages of Paris.